Welcome to a brand new year and a brand new episode of Health Connections, a show about people, health, and policy. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. State lawmakers will gather once more this month as a new session of the Tennessee General Assembly begins. The mountain of bills up for consideration will include legislation affecting health and medicine. One will take mental illness into account in criminal sentencing. Another will address suicide prevention. And will Medicaid expansion see the light of day in 2018? Surgeon and State Senator Richard Briggs has sponsored medical legislation in the past and will do so again this year. In this kickoff edition of Health Connections, he discusses health-related bills with Dr. Carol Myers.
You have introduced a bill that prohibits the imposition of the death sentence on people with severe mental illness without having to use the insanity defense. So what problem does this bill address, and how is what you're proposing different from the insanity defense?
I don't think that any of us would want to put to death people who have a severe illness where they don't know what they're doing. And I'll use the example of diabetes or a heart attack. If someone goes into a diabetic coma when they're driving, or they have a heart attack when they're driving, and the tragedy occurs where they kill someone, we would not want to put that person to death because a health issue caused that accident to occur. And I think we should look at mental illness the same way. People who are severely mentally ill, and this is a federal definition about what that is, really aren't responsible for what they do. We do have the insanity defense that can be used. What we're trying to do with this legislation is to cut down the cost of the whole court system and do the right thing. By avoiding a long and lengthy trial where the insanity defense is obviously used by the defense and is going to be opposed by the prosecutors, a judge can listen to the evidence, and there's several elements of this. Is that one, they have to have a previous diagnosis of one of the severe mental illnesses. Two, those definitions are defined in federal law. And then in three, they have to be in a state where they didn't know what they were doing when the crime was committed. If a judge determines that that's the case, the insanity defense won't be used, and this person will not be charged with a capital crime. He can still be charged with a crime. He can be convicted and sentenced to life without parole. But the taxpayer and the citizens aren't going through that multi-million-dollar expense of trying that person. Is that we'll go straight to a non-capital trial where with a guilty plea he could get a sentence of life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, but it's not the years and years and years of appeal that becomes so expensive.
Okay. Your response leads me to believe that there's precedent for this sort of bill in other states. Could you speak to that?
There is precedent of this in some other states, and if you really go back about 20 years nearly, the Supreme Court said we will not put to death people who are mentally retarded and are what we call to now the intellectual disabilities. They used the term mentally retarded because that's what was used at that time because it was the legal term. And we're really doing the same thing for the people who have severe mental illnesses.
Okay. So mental illness isn't just things like psychosis. It's also intellectual disabilities, traumatic brain injuries.
That's not correct. There's five mental illnesses, such as schizophrenia, some of the severe depressions, some of the severe bipolar illnesses. But these are defined in federal law, and these are what we're going to use. This is not up to the judge to say, well, he was has a severe personality disorder. That's not one of them. This is very strict federal definition.
Thanks for that clarification. What would your detractors about this bill say? What will the opposition be, or what will be the concerns about untoward consequences?
Well, I think even prosecutors, and this is the District Attorneys Association or the District Attorneys Conference, really are opposing this bill right now. I think there's a couple of reasons. One is they want to appear to be tough on crime. And I do want to say I have no problem with the death penalty personally. I think there's appropriate situations for it. But we know that in reality, someone that's severely mentally ill, we can go through the whole process. They can receive the death penalty. Even if that happens, as it could today, they'll sit on death row for the next 30 or 40 years. They're never going to be executed. We know that the cost is about three times that for a life without parole trial with all the appeals. It also doesn't allow closure for the families when this thing goes on for decades. But if you get the life without the possibility of parole, it closes it for the family, and it saves the taxpayers millions and millions of dollars.
I reviewed the bills that you filed during the 110th General Assembly, and I noticed a theme around mental health parity. So parity for our audience means that the treatment of mental health conditions and substance abuse disorders by health plans must be like the treatment for physical conditions. We have federal laws that require parity in certain sort of plans like group employer plans, the federal employees health benefit plans, Medicaid managed care such as 10Care, CHIP, exchange and market plans, and some state and local plans. So what does your bills that you have proposed around mental health parity aim to do?
What we intend to do is to treat mental illness just like any other illness. And if the health plan calls for a mental illness to be treated, then it has to be reimbursed and paid to hospitals and health care providers in the same manner as any other illness. For instance, if you have a heart attack and the contract that a hospital or a doctor has with an insurance company says that we'll pay you 1.5% of what Medicare pays, then it would be the same for mental illness diagnoses.
What's excluded today that's not under that umbrella of the federal law that we currently have? What will this add?
It really varies by insurance companies. Some insurance companies have parity already, and some don't. And what we're trying to bring in line is an equal playing field, really for both the patient as a consumer protection issue, but also to make it fair for the insurance companies, because there's some that do a very good job. They do what they're supposed to be doing with the reimbursement that they give to hospitals and healthcare providers, and some aren't. And what we want to do is to be certain that they all pay in the same manner as they would for other non-mental health diseases.
Great. Thank you. Well, what's your prediction about how the bills that you've introduced on parity, how they'll fare in the next session?
It's still unclear. I had a meeting back in the third week of December with some of the advocates for the mental health bill, and they seem to think that it's going pretty well. The stumbling block could be in the Commerce and Insurance Committee, particularly in the Senate, where they do not like government influence into the private industry, because really health insurance is a contract between an individual or a company and an insurance company. And the question is, should the government be involving themselves and inserting themselves in private contracts? And I don't think that they disagree with the idea about what we're proposing, but it's just a philosophical degree what is the government's role in private contracts.
Also noticed when I was looking at the bills you filed, an interest in suicide prevention. And for our listeners, let's just scope out the problem of suicide in Tennessee. On any given day, three people in our state die from suicide. Tragic statistic. It's the third leading cause of people ages 10 to 19. One person is lost per week in that age group. When we look at people over age 45, which we would be in that category, one a day. The most elevated risk time is middle age, and white males are by far at the highest risk. Firearms are involved in two-thirds of the suicides, and we know in Tennessee that the rates are highest in our rural areas. I have a particular interest in rural health care. So what do you aim to accomplish with the bills you have filed related to suicide prevention?
This is a tragedy, and it's more than just a statistic. As you may recall, between January 2017 and April 2017, right here in our community in Ferret High School, we had three young people committed suicide. Just a tragedy beyond most of our imaginations, our ability to conceive. I've had very long conversations with one of those mothers, and she was very generous in sharing a very painful situation with me. I filed this bill long before any of those happened. I filed it about a year ago in December for the 2017 session. And what the bill does, it doesn't deal with gun control, it doesn't deal with any of that, but what it does do, it does require mental health professionals to obtain specific training in recognizing suicidal tendencies. These can be people such as ministers who do counseling. It can be high school counselors. And we even included some people like the therapist that may be dealing with the elderly that have had strokes to recognize depression in them, where they would not be treating it, but they would be able to refer it to other healthcare professionals that treat these type of illnesses and are these type of tendencies, just so we don't get to the point to where we do have a tragedy on our hand. So it really came home to roost in our own community after this bill was filed, and I think people, particularly in Knox County, will understand now why this is so important.
Right. So do you anticipate passage of this bill, or what are the problems that you're...
We've had very little opposition to it. Okay. What the discussion's been over is how many hours of mandatory training are these professionals going to be required when they renew their license, and over what period? And I think we've reached a good compromise on that, and I don't anticipate any problems. I think everyone recognizes this is a very serious societal problem.
Well, a little bit of personal privilege here. I became interested in state lawmaking related to health and healthcare in the early 1980s. I'm dating myself, where I set up a rural primary care clinic, and I realized how important state laws are to health and healthcare. And I've had the pleasure of working with you on several bills and other policy matters. We don't always agree, but I always walk away feeling that it's been a fair shake. There's a bill filed last year that I hope will be acted on in 2018 after almost 30 years. It's a bill sponsored by Senator Sutherland and Representative Hawk, and it's on school nurses. I hope I see a school health nurse bill pass during my career. The national recommended standard is one school nurse per 750 students. In Tennessee, we're at 1 to 3,000, and the Sutherland-Hawk bill will call us into line with national standards. What are your thoughts and predictions about the school health nurse, which we know has a very large fiscal note?
I agree completely with everything you say, and you will see my full support behind this. One of the big issues we have in Tennessee that's even a broader issue than that is just access to care. And particularly in our rural areas, we've had many rural hospitals, especially in West Tennessee, that have closed. And when they close, the doctors leave, and a lot of the health care is lacking. The school nurses can fill some of that void, at least taking care of children. And as everyone knows, with the Affordable Care Act, it has not been universal health care in the state of Tennessee, but this does something that, at least for our school-aged children, will bring an element of health care back. And also, as you mentioned, we have more and more kids going to school today that have serious health problems. We all know about the peanut allergies. We know about diabetes. We know about other health issues where we need a trained health care professional there to look after them. And I think it's just indispensable to have a healthcare professional in our schools, and I'll support that completely. You are correct. The biggest hang-up that we have on any bill, no matter what its virtues and what it provides, is going to be the fiscal note.
Representative Faison was on our last episode of Health Connections to talk about medical cannabis. He shared his views very passionately on why he thinks medical cannabis should be improved in Tennessee. What are your thoughts on medical cannabis and the bills that we expect to see debated in 2018?
I sat on the marijuana healthcare task force that we had. It was a joint task force that was appointed by the Lieutenant Governor and the Speaker of the House. And we had several meetings during the summer where we had specialists coming in from Vanderbilt University on addiction. We had folks coming in from Colorado where marijuana is legalized, including for recreational issues. And I will say that Representative Faison is a very sincere person. He's well-researched. Personally, I like him a lot and consider him a friend. However, I think he's off track here. And we have a mechanism in the United States when we find a drug or a product that may have some pharmacological benefit, that you make application with the Food and Drug Administration. This is the FDA. They can review the research. They come up with indications, effectiveness, contraindications, interactions with other drugs, dosing adjustments you need to make in people that are elderly, in children, or in people that have renal failure or liver failure or other issues. What are the issues in pregnancy? And these are the things that I think we have to look at, and we have an agency for this. For some reason, the folks that are promoting the marijuana are wanting to bypass this. We've never done this with any drug. And the state legislature is not the place to practice medicine and evaluate the effectiveness of drugs on all these issues we talk about. It's not the place for that occurs, for that to occur. I do believe that there are certain pharmacological benefits to some of the components of marijuana. Those need to be evaluated and studied in the proper forum, which is the Food and Drug Administration, and then they can determine what we need to do with it. It's not the state legislature that needs to be practicing medicine.
You talked about the Medical Cannabis Task Force. There was another task force this summer. It seems as if task forces are gaining relevancy, meaning, and clout from what we've seen in years past, and we had a task force on opioids. I could list the recommendations, or I can defer to you to say, what was the work of that group? You know, what do you think are the most important recommendations, and where do you think this is going, sir?
I'll have to preface anything I say by not having the – I was not on that committee, so I didn't get to listen to all the testimony. But I do think it's very important for our listeners to understand that I really think the number one, number two, and number three healthcare issue in the state right now all is related to the opioids. We had over 1,600 people die of opioid overdoses in Tennessee last year. We had 950 die in automobile accidents. It's throwing a monkey wrench into our government's plans for jobs, education, and economic development. I was out in right here in Knoxville. We have Caremark, which is the mail order business for CVS pharmacies. They've just signed a new contract with a health insurance company. They're trying to hire 300 new people. They can't find people that aren't testing positive for drugs. And we have to look at this entirely different than we did before. I've attended two national meetings on the opioid with other state legislatures. I think we're doing a good job in Tennessee right now. We've closed down over half of the pill mills that were really operating, I'm not going to say illegally, but they weren't serving the public interest. We've closed those down. We've done other things to limit the access. What we are lacking is in rehabilitation. And we can go ahead and squeeze some more on how the pills are distributed. We need to cut down the number that doctors are giving after operations, maybe limiting it to a five-day supply. Maybe doing other things to monitor the top prescribers more closely. I think we're going to have to turn our attention now on what we're going to do for rehabilitation to get these people back to where they can go to work and resume normal life within our society. And I think everybody recognizes that this is a problem that's much, much bigger than just a health problem. It deals with our schools. It deals because we have these babies that are born that are now becoming school age, and they have learning disabilities and behavioral problems. It deals with crime. I've heard the Knox County Sheriff and I've heard the Chief of Police in Knoxville say that over 90 to 95% of the crime is related to this. It deals with families being broken up. We have children that are taken away from these addicted families and have to be placed. So it's a huge societal problem that we're having to deal with. We have not seen the governor's agenda. It could be the number one issue that we're dealing with in the legislature in 2018.
Good. And we'll know what the governor has in store at the end of January. Well, I appreciate that answer, almost spoken like a true public health professional, looking at upstream determinants, prevention, and then early as possible and effective treatment. Is there anything I've not asked you about that you think is important as we look to the opening of the Tennessee General Assembly? And for our audience, that occurs by state law on the second Tuesday in January. What do we have to look forward to in the 3 to 4 months that you will be meeting in Nashville?
One of the things that we have to remember is that this is an election year, and maybe that shouldn't interfere with or have any effect on what we do with our laws, but it does mean that the session will be shorter and we may avoid some of the more controversial issues. That's just a political fact of life. One of the things that at some point we're going to have to address, not only in Tennessee, but really nationwide, is our access to care. In particular, we have so many people today that don't have insurance, and even those that are going to the insurance exchanges and buying insurance are finding they have head-swimming deductibles, head-swimming co-pays that really make it effectively like not having insurance. I think that's going to be a huge issue that at some point we're going to have to address. We have just the pure access to care. We don't have enough health care providers, particularly in our rural areas. I think we need to have an expanded role for some of our mid-level providers. And it's just a question of how to do that, how to fit them in to our present medical structure, and to be certain that the training and oversight is sufficient where the public is getting good health care. We're having our rural hospitals that are closing, and a lot of that's related to unreimbursed care, which gets back to the first point I'm making. So we do have serious issues in Tennessee on access to care and the cost of care and the cost of drugs. We're going to have to address those at some point.
Medicaid expansion, in whatever format, what are your predictions during the election year? No go?
It'll be a no-go this year. I think not so much because it's an election year in Tennessee, but because of the uncertainty in Washington. What I hear many of the legislators say is that we don't want to file a waiver with Medicare, start a program, and then find that it's going to go away 6 months later.
Yeah, boy, this uncertainty has lasted a long time. Dr. Briggs, it's been a delight to have you here on Health Connections today. Thank you so much for your forthright answer, and again, for your service in so many ways, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you and to work with you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Health Connections. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth.